Hello and welcome to Meenal's World, an alternative podcast where you'll be inspired, motivated, might make you cry a bit sometimes. It happened to me the last couple of weeks. And this week we have something very new. We have a talk show style sort of episode where I have my guest Sonam. And thank you, Sonam, for keeping up with all my crazy ideas leading up to this day. And thank you, Roop, as well, from Aurora Productions for filming this episode. Sonam started a mental health group called Reroute. She started this in London because she realized that a lot of people in our community don't have a medium where they can speak to people and discuss how they actually feel. We live in a country here where our parents and maybe even our grandparents may not even fluently speak the English language. So there's a lot of barriers for our community to discuss our mental health issues. So today I have the lovely Sonam with me and we'll talk about the work that she does, and hopefully people can actually get in touch with Sonam in London or maybe even across the world and discuss how they feel with us. So without further ado, let's jump right into the show. Thank you for joining us, Sonam. No problem. Thank you for coming all the way, or all the way.
So, 40 minutes is a bit of a drive.
Yeah. Well, Sonam, as I said in my introduction, you know, you're doing some great work for our South Asian community here in London. What inspired you to start this?
So, like, it's a little bit twofold. I think I grew up in a city that is predominantly white, British populated, and I always felt a little bit like, oh, I don't have many people that I can resonate with, I don't have people that I can talk to. I think growing up, like, I had a little bit of anxiety, but I didn't really know what that was. And I think because it was just never really around as a subject, you know, the knowledge wasn't there, the awareness wasn't there. So, like, that's like me. And then I sort of grew up to be the adult that I was, and I ended up working in HR.
HR people. It's like, you know, everyone, all the doctors in the hospital are like, HR, man, just getting through to HR is so difficult. And when I spoke to you, like, I work in HR, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's the thing, like, you have to be there everywhere and you're hot on everyone's case. And, you know, employee well-being, employee engagement became such a hot thing kind of when I graduated. Yeah. And my employer basically sent me on this course that was mental health first aid. Mm. And if, you know, anyone that listens to this eventually has not done it, I really would encourage you to do it. It's so good. And I just thought, oh, sweet, this is 2 days off work. You know, I can might just get a little bit out of it. And it just completely blew me away. Mm. Like the depth and the breadth of what mental health illness, mental health, well-being, all of it, I was just like overwhelmed with.
What surprised you the most when you went to this?
Well, that course? I kind of self-diagnosed myself, like, whilst being on the course. Like, he went through, the facilitator went through, you know, absolutely most of the conditions from kind of the more extreme to kind of mild. Mm. And I just started resonating so much with anxiety, and I thought, like, oh, crap, like, this is me, you know, but I didn't know that. Mm. And I didn't know that, oh, if I had kind of clocked onto this maybe a little bit earlier, the kind of narrative of my life might have changed.
Because it's funny you say that, because we see our lives as either being happy or sad.
Yeah.
And we restrict ourselves to these two very specific emotions.
Yeah.
And we never actually see our life as a timeline. And happiness has its peaks and troughs. And you don't have, you can't have every single day being happy. And you can't really have every single day being the opposite. Yeah. So it's interesting that you mentioned this timeline of feelings and emotions. So if you had to describe this timeline, what would be either end of each side of the timeline?
For like mental health in general? So I think at the very extreme end is when you're completely debilitated by your condition and you are not able to find the joy in the activities that you once found joy into. You know, if you're right at that end, then, you know, you basically are one, you need professional help and it's probably not the group. Would it really help you, because our group is more about peer support. And if you're at this end, you're kind of like me, really. You function, you go about your daily life, but there's something there that's, you know, it sometimes is a bit stronger. It's like that little voice, you know, like sometimes it's a little bit stronger.
I think everyone has that, though.
Yeah.
I think it's something that everyone has experienced in their daily life. So I think all of us have kind of been on this spectrum at some
point
or
another. Yeah, well, that's where the phrase comes from, isn't it? Everyone does have mental health. It's just that you might not have a mental health illness at any given time. Yeah.
But we're all battling something at some point in our life.
So coming back to your original question, I went on the course and I thought, I don't want the conversation to stop there. Like, I want to have, now that I know, that there's this whole world and that we can do a lot just by talking about it, I want to continue that. And I looked around in Harrow and I thought, there must be something for me. And I remember, so similar to Mind, there's Rethink, a large mental health illness charity, and they run a group in Harrow. So I was really excited. I remember I'll go along.
Yeah.
And it was just full of older white British people. And I was this is not
So
this
kind of coming in full circle, going back to when you were younger.
Exactly.
You felt the same way.
Exactly And I was but I'm in Harrow and every person I'm seeing is brown. How is this happening? And so, I didn't resonate there. There is a sort of group in Harrow. I think they're still running, but their members are 60 and over. And I was I just can't resonate. Yeah. And, I just want something that's an informal, chilled out space. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily even need to have a mental health illness. You just need to be interested in increasing your knowledge, increasing your awareness, and you can just come along and listen.
But you went to this Rethink group, was it specifically because you were looking for help, or was it just I'm going to just see what this is all about?
Yeah, it was the second. It was I want to talk about mental health. I want to explore this. I've not grown up ever really talking about it, so I don't know how to articulate how I feel sometimes, at the time. I'm married, I'm very happily married, but I can't really talk to my husband because he isn't really on that end of the spectrum as I am. He sees things really differently. And so I don't really have the words as to how to put I'm feeling across. Mm. And I thought a group like that, you can start conversing with strangers. Yep. It might then translate outside. Mm-hmm. But, that wasn't the space for me, quite clearly.
It's interesting because I was just reading up yesterday some statistics on depression, specifically depression. And over 200 million plus people suffer from depression worldwide. And is such a big number. We talk about, as a doctor, we talk about hip fractures or ankle fractures and all these kinds of, but depression, mental health is something that's so, so much bigger than what we think it is. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think people struggle to talk about so much because it's not a physical sign we see.
Yeah.
It's not something we can physically say, I have a wound or I have broken my arm, fix it.
Mm.
And it's not even something you can translate into numbers, if you've got diabetes, your glucose is this level, or cholesterol. Yeah,
subjective.
There's nothing that we can tally it up to.
Yeah.
So when you have these people in your support groups coming in, how do you get them to talk about it? Because as you said, you couldn't articulate how you felt, and maybe people are better at it, maybe people are going through the same thing as you, but some people may even find it even more difficult than you did, or you do at the moment, because I find it very difficult.
Yeah.
And I speak all the time, on the podcast, I'm always talking, and I find it very difficult. So how do you encourage people to open up, or do you give them any tools to describe how they feel?
So I think the first thing is we've always been that there is no pressure to share. Someone even leaving their house on any given Saturday, our meetings are always on a Saturday, any given Saturday to come to a room full of strangers, even just sitting there, you've taken a proactive step towards bettering your mental health.
Yeah.
So we always at the beginning start by acknowledging that, you coming is contribution and we appreciate that.
Yeah.
And that's a lot in itself. And then I think we just kind of try and have that consistent approach. So our meetings are every month and someone knows that they can come. They don't have to say anything.
Mm.
They don't have to really share until they feel comfortable. They become, now it's become, there are regulars and it's a social thing and we go out for drinks and bowling and stuff. So now people, they have their own journey with whenever they feel comfortable in sharing. Mm. So I think we've always been really patient. We've been quite taken a really laid back approach to that, because people, just by listening and having their feelings validated, if I go along and someone's talking about their anxiety with anything, silently I could just feel validated with that, because it's they also feel it. I'm not going cuckoo in my own world.
Yeah.
And in terms of tools, we do try and do a lot of pairs-based discussions, we do group discussions, we do like one-on-one activity speakers. I think it's just about mixing up the format every time because a different thing will work for different people.
But I think the main the setting in itself of having a social setting is already a big start for people, because I'm sure a lot of people who are suffering or struggling to even leave the house, as you said, just being in that social setting has already taken a big step for them. And how do you create these workshops? I mean, do you have anyone on your team who's trained, or
like, it's just such a mixed bag, like it is. I'm not working in the field of mental health. I kind of work in an office, and I've done mental health first aid, and my what I bring to the table is more like creativity and lived experience, if anything else. As the group was forming, so about 6 months in, a lady contacted me, Jinnal. And she kind of wanted to get involved, or at the time she wanted to start her own project. And then she started getting involved with Reroute because we thought that, you know, we may as well join hands and do something together. So she is a trained psychotherapist.
Okay.
So she brings the professional credibility to the table. But we're always quite clear that, you know, it's not a professional space. Yeah. It's peer, equal support. And yeah, like between us, you know, there's never really been a blueprint for the meetings, because as far as we knew, there wasn't anything like this out there in Harrow. So we set the theme, we get the material, we find the speakers, and we just kind of roll with it, to be fair. And I think that informal nature of it is what makes it work.
So well. Now, how many, around approximately, how many people do you coming to these?
So I'd say we peak at like 15. 12 to 15.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, but we had, our last one was yesterday, and we had it women's only, and we promoted it in a few different networks, and we actually had 20 people also at yesterday's.
That's quite incredible, because I think when we talk about mental health issues in our community, I think we're even too afraid to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
So for someone to leave the house and say, actually, I think I need help,
yeah,
is already a big step in itself. So how, when you're marketing, it's not the right word, but when you try to spread the word about what you do, what do you say to people and say, okay, this is actually the right place for you? Because some people are too scared to even admit.
Yeah. So when I started it, Reroute was originally supposed to be for 18 to 35 year olds.
Yeah.
So for that reason, I stuck with the name Reroute, because I really wanted it something abstract. Like on Facebook, if someone liked the page, you know, it obviously comes up on different people's timelines. So I was like, oh, I don't want mental health, you know, coming up when they may not be ready to share that on their Facebook with their Facebook friends. So that's where it started. So we've always tried to use terminology like mental wealth or well-being or mindful or kind of, you know, that kind of stuff. We always try to not put the label mental health, because it is also just open to anybody, you know. It's not just someone that might have like anxiety or depression or something a little bit more serious. It could just be for someone like that wants to learn a little bit more about it, or that wants to make a change in the community. So we've always tried to keep the phrasing quite open. And then we just get a lot of direct messages, we get a lot of like, you know, Facebook messages, and at that point we're really clear with people as to what the guidelines are.
So Sunam, going back to the very beginning where you said that you were raised in a community that was predominantly white, where was it, in Bristol? Yeah, that is quite what was actually going through your mind as a child when you were dealing with anxiety and all these things? Was it a specific event in your life? Was it the fact that you were just South Asian trying to fit in? Or did something else happen for you to suffer with your mental health?
Yeah, like I think the more I think about it, I think it is a little bit inherited. Like I can see now when I've increased my knowledge of mental health, and I can just, you know, you've been talking about it for so long, as you probably know, you can start seeing things around you. So I think it is something on my dad's side that's kind of inherited. I think it is obviously a little bit about that, because none of my friends could resonate with me. Like their problems were, you know, just nowhere near the same problems that I was having. And as a youngster,
when you say problems, you mean anxiety related problems?
Anxiety or wider issues, you know. Their issues were like, my parents won't let me go out till 2 a.m. and I was like, oh well, you know, just can't even go pretend out. I just can't even go out. So it's that. And I think as a youngster, when you don't really fit in, then you start getting so self-conscious, and that amplifies your anxiety so much more. So, yeah, I think it was a combination of of that kind of stuff.
You mentioned inheritance, and I always wonder, do you think we're born happy or sad? And that changes throughout our life? Do you think we're born with any specific emotion?
I think you genetically inherit traits from your parents. Mm. I don't think they're labelled like happy or sad. Mm. I can definitely see like my anxiety, I get really fidgety if things aren't done on time. I can see that comes from my dad. Like,
yeah.
You know, I can just, you know, you can pick that up. But no, like the happy, sad thing, I think that changes on a daily basis or even an hourly basis sometimes.
Yeah.
So I don't think that can really be defined.
Because I also think we sort of develop as humans depending on where we're born as well.
Yeah.
So Finland, Denmark, this Scandinavian countries are very, very happy places.
Yeah.
And they're always coming at the top.
Yes.
And we were not born in those countries. You were born here, I was born in Gibraltar. So I think that our environment plays such a big role on how we turn out to be. So I think now, for example, like now I'm married and we're hoping to have a family in the future. The location where we actually raise our kids for me is so important, actually, because I'm like, well, if I raise my kids in a sunny country, it's quite likely they'll probably just turn out to be happier just because of the environment. Whereas if in the UK, for example, where I hate to say this, but it's miserable most of the time. It is quite miserable most of the time in terms of weather and stuff. And I think that we don't actually acknowledge that because we live in a society where we're just trying to get to the end with our rat race life, work life. We're born, we study, we try to get to the best university, we try to get the best job, and we just try to get to the end. Whereas where I was raised in Gibraltar, it was so different.
Mm.
So, so different. I mean, we were concerned about our results and everything like from school, but it was like, it's not the end of the world if it doesn't work out, because we knew that we had the beach next to us.
Yeah.
So we could just enjoy.
There is merit in that. Yeah. And I think like, especially South Asians living outside of, you know, their homeland, I think there has been an increased added pressure because there's the whole thing like, oh, our parents made such a big sacrifice, like we really have to like succeed, or we really have to make that worth it. Like, you know, they sort of gave up a lot to move countries or whatever the story is. So for us, as a, I guess it's a first generation, you know, of the immigrant, the immigrant parents, it's a little bit like, oh, you know, you have to live up to that. And then you also have to do things that make you happy. I think that kind of adds an added pressure.
I think every generation has their own sort of problems to fit in. Like our parents had problems where they had to sort of try find a better life for their family, and that caused them their mental health issues. And our generation is all about trying to be successful or trying to give ourselves the best life. That creates even a different type of anxiety. So I think every generation has a different reason to struggle with these problems. Talking about our parents' generation, Soonam, how, as a reroute, as an entity, how do you open up these conversations with the elder generation? Because as I mentioned in my introduction, I don't think there's a specific term for depression in Hindi or in Punjabi. I think there is one, and I read it up yesterday, but if I pronounce it, I think I'm just going to sound like... I don't think that'll sound great.
I don't know it myself.
I think there's a scientific word for it.
Oh, okay.
But it's never used in common language in India. And if you speak to people in India, they will say... They will talk in Hindi, and then the word depressed will be in English.
Yeah.
So, you know, they'll continue with what they're saying and they say, blah, blah, depressed.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no specific translation for it. So when I talk to my parents about depression or any sort of mental health issues, they just see it as one emotion. Anxiety, depression, even suicidal thoughts, anything. It all comes
all
under one
umbrella,
bubble because they don't have that sort of vocabulary to explain everything. So as reroute, how would you try and encourage these conversations in our parents or our grandparents?
So it's really difficult. I think you have to start there. Like I was 25 or 26 when I started reroute, and I was struggling just through that period, you know, of those years that I've been on the earth, you know, because I've never talked about mental health. I've never talked about, you know, mental health illness. I was struggling, and if you imagine now, if I was to go to my mum who's 60, who's never spoken about it her whole life and seen so much more, then, you know, you're basically starting at basics, and you have to get like the very definitions. You have to clarify.
It's like learning a new language, isn't it?
Basically, but I would say like now there's a really good breadth of material out there. Like Deepika Padukone's done some amazing stuff to normalise these conversations. There are films that have realistically portrayed, you know, mental health illness in Bollywood.
Yeah.
There are articles, there are people that are speaking about it that I think would resonate with the older generation much more better. And so I think you can use that as a crux to kind of drive conversations. Mm. And we do this in Reroot. We print off articles and we just have these loose discussions and it gets like the narrative flowing and it gets it evolving a little bit. So that's helped a lot. One idea that we played with, and we've not really been able to do this, we wanted to get into places of worship. And
so
like I've seen that a lot of mosques are doing this. They have like well-being centres or something. Gurdwaras could do the same, mandirs could do the same. And I think if it was there, it's a really tailored, targeted approach. And I think you could, you know, get a lot of the older generation talking about something. Especially like, I mean, we were just playing with this idea, like if a priest, you know, started talking about mental health, then that would automatically validate it because that's a person of authority and they would be so likely to listen. We don't know how we'd ever get around to achieving that, but I think stuff like that, you have to go at it in a way that works for them.
Well, I think we're quite lucky now in our generation because we have a lot of priests, you could say, or swamis who are quite modernized now.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think these people are a bit more approachable to talk about. I think the difficulty is like going to India, for example, and going to some very conservative places. I mean, you're seeing priests saying that women who have periods can't even go into the kitchen. Like,
that was awful.
You're seeing stuff like that on the internet and you're like, how can you even start a discussion about depression with this person? Yeah. It seems impossible. Yeah. I'm not saying it is impossible, but it seems impossible.
India's just an anomaly, to be fair, because there is, on one hand, some people doing some amazing stuff.
But that only comes from a power. This is what really frustrates me, because the people who are doing amazing stuff, and hats off to them, they're doing great work. But that's a lot of it's coming from a place of privilege. They're in a place, specific place in society that allows them to say these things without even getting battered or shamed by anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you have a lady in the slums in Delhi or in Mumbai, how do you even start to help these people? It's so difficult.
Yeah.
And I think that people of authority in India are doing great work to go into these sort of deprived areas to encourage people to talk about how they feel and stuff. But again, India is such a big country.
Yeah.
So many people, like, where do you even start? And it's not even the people the size of the country, but it's also different cultures within one country. Yeah. So you're tackling so many different things. So I guess in a place like London, maybe it's a little bit easier because we're kind of under the same bubble in terms of culture and society and, you know, the way we live. So it's probably a little bit easier. But my mum, for example, if I tell her, oh, mum, I'm feeling a bit sad today, a bit depressed, she'd be like, well, you've got money, you've got a job,
you've got a house. They see those broader things. Yeah. And even with me, like, they see, oh, you got married. Like, it's really, I've lived a really textbook life, and it's just happened that way. Like, I got married, I was, like, 25 or something, you know. And it's all, like, the Gujarati, like, you know, perfect. But it's like, but I still have anxiety. Like, they're not mutually exclusive. It doesn't mean just because I'm married and just because I'm happy that I don't have days where it's, like, really, really, like, an anxious life. You know, they're a little bit reluctant, I think, to accept that you can have, like, that little grey area where everyone is existing, to be fair, because for them everything was so black and white and you kind of had to, well, you had the front that you put onto the outside people, and then everything else just kind of got like swept under or you just had to troop through things. But you know, that has led to, and the statistics speak for itself, you know, like South Asian men and the suicide rates, and you know, it's not helped the community, you know, living that kind
of life. Well, I think the idea my parents have is that happiness shouldn't really come from material things. So if I tell them that, mom, not having a great day or whatever, and she'll say, well, just think about the bigger picture, as you said, the broader sense. But I think our parents, or maybe our family's idea of happiness, is quite different because they see it from a religious point of view and a spiritual point of view, that your happiness comes from your connection with God or your connection with the higher purpose and higher belief. And the more material you have, it's like the more poison you have, right? That's poisoning your mind. And the truth is, Sunam, I really do think that we are, I guess, blessed and cursed at the same time as a generation, where we're blessed in the sense that we have so many opportunities in front of us, but cursed at the same time that, where do we start? you know, because you look at, I mean, look at the podcast, look at what you're doing, but you see other people talking about these things and you see, oh, they're so successful, they're getting somewhere, but why am I not at that stage either? So I think we have to sort of disconnect ourselves from that sometimes as a generation and think, actually, what actually makes me truly happy? And we forget to do that sometimes because our life is so fast-paced that we have to do videos, we have to socialize, we have to put this on Instagram, Snapchat, that we forget actually, well, what defines my happiness?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think, like, though, the thing with this generation, what I've noticed a lot around the friends and everything, like, everyone's trying to get to some sort of higher purpose. Like, it's not good enough just going to work, just coming back, going to the gym. Like, you know, that was okay, like, maybe 30 years ago. Yeah. Maybe it wasn't even then. Maybe at a certain age you just realized that life is about that little something more. What can you give back?
Yeah.
What can you, you know, leave to the world? What can you do to help? And we're all trying. And yeah, I think it's a real shame that this comparison culture comes into the South Asian community a lot more than other places. But I think even other communities are realizing it with social media. But we grew up just being compared to our cousins and stuff. So we've had it like all our lives. It's nothing really that new. And I think it's a shame because everyone is literally trying their best. No one really gives
it. Well, it goes back to the hierarchy of needs, right? Like, if you got your job, you got your money, you got your family, then it's only at that point you can think, okay, I'm going to try and aim for something higher than that, like a spiritual purpose. Now, I met a few teachers back at home in Gibraltar, and they were talking about creating more lessons, and in the classroom as well, talking about well-being and spiritual health. And obviously, when I was a child, none of that was even, it was non-existent. No one would talk about it in school. And I remember even when I would get bullied in school for whatever reason, probably because I was quite a chubby kid. you know, you'd talk to the teachers and say, look, I'm upset, or you'd be crying, and you'd say, well, and teachers would never really do anything about it, because they're just like, well, just kids, you know. But now they're trying to create, now the education system is trying to create an angle where, okay, we're going to teach kids about spiritual and mental health. And do you think that's something that you want to do with ReRoot?
Yeah, I think, like, it has to start young. Like, I mean, all of us that come to the group, we've all understood and recognised that had we had the knowledge, like, in our younger years, it would have changed things dramatically. And only when you have that can you even help, like, people around you and stuff. So, yeah, it definitely is something that we want to do, whether it's at some point with our own kids or it's with, I mean, not even your kids. Like, it could just be, like, a younger cousin or it could be, like, someone younger in your family. Yeah. Go into schools, and I think it's like completely right what you're saying. Schools and universities now have like well-being counselors, they have it on the curriculum.
But there should be, we spend 80% of our lives, well, at least until this age, there. I mean, we're spending so much of our time in the education system, they should be providing us with ways to keep our sanity, really, because it's not easy to go through those years. I think it was just 2 days ago, I saw something on Facebook about there's a child in Australia, I think he was about four years old. He suffers from dwarfism, and he was bullied at school. I don't know if you saw this, but came back from school, his mum picked him up, and she videoed him, and he was in tears, like, just completely shattered, saying, I don't want to go to school anymore, I'm being bullied, and he actually said the words, give me a knife, I want to end my life. And Sonam, I think that really took me away. Like, how can a four-year-old even think about that? I mean, he must have been bullied it's horrible. And I think it just gained traction over social media, and like celebrities came out and spoke up for him. And I think a few days ago, he went into like a rugby game, and they supported him, and he was really happy with it. But he is just one child in Australia. How many other children are going through this?
There's loads about it, of like, you know, online bullying and the effects that
Again, it's
having.
It's a generational problem, cyberbullying. I mean, our parents obviously never had to go through that. Well, I didn't at least. I never had that issue when I was growing up, but now our kids will have these issues, and we need to think about all of that. And apart from bullying, like school bullying and cyberbullying, do you think there's anything else that's playing a role in finding depression at a younger age in children?
Sometimes when we've talked about it in the group, like, I don't know if there's just more awareness about it now because we have the knowledge. Yeah. Like, if it is increased or if it's just that we're finding it more because the statistics are coming out a lot more, research is actually being done about it and stuff. Like, there is that, like, argument to it as well. And I think some of it is just the fact that, yeah, there's all these variables that kids today are having to take into consideration. So there's an increased sense of, well, there's just not much stability, like, at the moment. You know, when we were growing up, okay, it was, there was this beaten path, but it was like, you can go to university and you can get a job, you know. Now there's no guarantee, even if you have the degree in your hand, that you're going to get a job that you want. Politics, you know, everything is just chaos at the moment, and they're growing up in this world, and it's bound to filter through and affect their well-being. Like, it's just no surprise.
It's quite a scary time to be a teenager, I think so
because
when we were younger, we just assumed we'd go to university, get
exactly.
a job, and that's it.
Yeah.
But now, like, my some of my cousins in India are just like, Mila, I don't know what to study. I was like, to be honest, I don't blame you, because I wouldn't know either, because we explore so much now as younger people, where we explore all our passions and hobbies, and we're not afraid to do that.
Yeah.
That we become a sort of jack of all trades. And then when it comes to the point where you have to sort of align to one specific path, it becomes almost impossible to figure out what you want to do.
And I think the disposability of stuff that's available online, on social media, like, the focus is a little bit hard. So if you don't have a clear path, or if you're not, like, I was one of those kids, you know, there wasn't one subject where I was like standout good in, but at that time it was okay, because you could just like meander through, and you could do business studies at uni, which is what I ended up doing, and you can just find yourself somewhere. But now it's not, you know, it's just not that easy anymore. So
what has been the biggest sort of thing that you've seen in any of these workshops where you've been like, wow, this is actually like something that someone has told you, and you've said, wow, actually this is really bad, or like, this is really difficult to go through, and you've been at a point where you're like, I don't know how to help you. Has that happened before?
It does, yeah. I mean, people do eventually start feeling really comfortable to share their personal stories.
Yeah.
And there was one, a mother, she had come from quite far, actually, and she was just, her daughter had been diagnosed with severe anxiety, and she was just perplexed as to how to handle this. And it was really, like, and you know, and you could just see that she was distraught. Like, she was just a mum, like, trying to do her best, but she didn't have any awareness of what is anxiety and where to start with it, and just how much it might be affecting her daughter. And she sort of, you know, there were tears, and it was just like, she was describing what's going on at home, and obviously it sounded like her daughter was, you know, quite far down the line, and clearly was seeking professional help. And you just kind of think, like, this is, you know, this could be any one of the parents that, you know, and for this to happen,
it could be us one day.
It could be, you just don't know, like, how to handle it.
So do you have a system where you tell, where there's a point where you say, okay, I think you need professional help?
Yeah.
And you are you able, do you have that capacity to specifically refer someone, or you have to leave it to them to do?
No, we can't get into the professional side of it at all. We have, like, we've created documents and stuff where we signpost to relevant, other organisations that are more therapy-based or more professional-based, or obviously, you know, your GP, but we all know the issues that are there.
NHS is a whole different thing.
It's a whole different debate. Yeah. But no, at some point, I think we do kind of draw the line, and you have to be really clear about that, because there isn't another group like ours that is just like peer support, especially for such a wide age range.
Yeah.
So you're going to get like a really mixed bag of stuff. So you have to be quite clear that, you know, for anything other than literally peer support, you know, you have to go to a professional.
And working in HR, do you specifically work with, in your company, the entity you work with?
Yeah.
Do you specifically work with anybody who suffers from mental health? Have you created workshops, or have you created a space, an open space, where people can come to HR and say, I have this issue with work, the stress is getting to me, I need help?
I've been really quite lucky that all of the organisations I've worked at have employee assistant programmes, so confidential services that they can call for help. Because sometimes, as much as HR try to be the friendly face for the whole organisation, people aren't comfortable coming to a colleague and sharing stuff right off the bat. So having that, like an external outsourced provider, you know, the take up on that has apparently been really good when we look at the reports and stuff. In addition to that, I really like running events at work. So we do like Halloween dress up days to raise money for Rethink. And then we have like, we celebrate, you know, Time to Talk Day, and we put out the materials and stuff. But in terms of running workshops, I think it just works better when it's an external
when it's something else
provider. Yeah, like get them out of work, like get them to another location with someone else, fresh faces.
Yeah,
I think people then start really opening up.
Because I think in Norway, one of my friends who works as a doctor was saying that they have, I think every few months they have a weekend where the work actually says you need to just go away.
Yeah,
and they create a trip and they explore nature and and it. Obviously, the aim behind that is to tackle mental health or stress or anything, but it's not sort of advertised in that way.
Yeah.
They're just saying, it's part of work, just go. And then, you know, obviously the aim of that is to just sort of relax and enjoy nature and hopefully de-stress.
Yeah.
But we don't, I mean, in the NHS where I work, obviously that system is not there, and I understand why, because it's such a big entity, big organisation to take care of doctors, nurses, midwives, healthcare assistants. And not even that, Sonam. I think even in the NHS, you've got cleaners, you've got domestic services, the caterers. There's so many different people. Like, where do you start?
But I think for a vast organisation, you have to give and enable the line managers or heads of department a little bit of authority to be able to do that. Like, you can't have one guy sitting at the top telling how to do it. You know? You'd have to filter that and delegate it.
But I think the mentality with specifically with the NHS is that, I mean, I have a lot of great doctors I work around with, and I can always tell them, like, look, I think I need a day off or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're very understanding, and that's what I love about working in my hospital specifically. But I think a lot of people are too afraid to say, I need a day off, or I need stress leave, or I need anything. And I think that's when it becomes very, very difficult. So do you suggest anything to these people? Like, what can someone in that position do if they feel like there's no one to help them in their organization? Is there anything else they can do?
I'm not
see, it's HR. This is what HR always says. Actually, you know what? I'm not sure.
Yeah, but
I'm just kidding. I'm just joking.
But it is true that the very first thing is you must have an open relationship with your line manager at the very least.
Yeah.
Like, it is so key to a good work-life balance, to just a good working life in general. If you're not able to foster that, I can't see how you'd be able to get into a position where you...
Yeah, well, I think the alternative is just step outside and look for a support group like Reroute or something else. I mean, that's something else that people can do, because not all organisations and companies have hit that stage where mental health is something that they want to tackle.
Yeah,
because...
and I think if they get to a group and they start, like I was saying before, you know, if you start normalising the conversation for yourself and you're able to then vocalise your feelings, you're more articulate, there's better chance that you can then take that into work or take it somewhere else once you've built up that skill.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you probably would, but that still kind of leaves the proactiveness with the individual to do something, which is a shame, because, you know, not everyone is able
I think that's
to
the biggest
that
problem with mental health, actually, is that we rely on people to tell us.
Yeah.
But sometimes we need to get it out of people because there's no other way to do it. So Sonam, just to before we finish off, what's your goal with Reroute? What do you want to achieve in the next few years or next decade?
Well, first of all, we hope it's going for the next decade. But I think, like, the goal was always to empower people to make a change. Like, the community, and this came up yesterday at the women's meeting, you know, back in the day, several hundreds or 100 years ago, there were some customs that were in our culture. And they were never meant to be, like, regressive or, you know, oppress women or kind of hold us back. But we've not really evolved with the times and we're still kind of there. And that's why there's so much taboo, there's stigma. And, you know, it's just creating a culture of shame that we kind of need to shrug off. So with Reroute, I think we just want to keep it going, make other groups around London, hopefully, you know, get into schools, get into universities and have, like, a really big online presence so that it just normalizes the conversation around mental health and to a point where it doesn't have to be as lovely as this setting has been. You know, we don't have to come somewhere special to have these conversations. You can just have it and it's easy, breezy, and then it just becomes like a part of everyday life, and then I think people wouldn't struggle to open up. Get bigger, really.
How would you define your happiness? What does being happy mean to you,
apart from, like, a chocolate bar? It would probably be my happiness, I think, like, to take it, like, a little bit wider, like, as a woman, like, almost 30, I think it's, like, something when you feel like you don't need anyone's validation. I think that's happiness, when it doesn't really depend on anyone else. Because obviously growing up as a South Asian girl, you're kind of, you know, you have a lot of voices thrown at you.
Yeah,
and you're told a lot of things, how to be and stuff. I think happiness is when you can just, without need to justify yourself, you can just own your own
attitude. It's a really interesting point, Sonam, because I think over the last few weeks or few months, I've created that mentality with myself.
Yeah.
I'm like, screw it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to think about what other people say. Yeah. I'm not going to ask for anyone's, let alone permission, even validation, like, am I doing this right and all that. Like, even when I started with the podcast and all that, I didn't ask anyone for advice, actually, because I was like, you know what, I'm just going to do it. Because you're going to get lots of noises, lots of voices coming and saying, oh, but you're a doctor and you're working full time and you're married and you're a wife. And, and I'm like, well, yeah, I know I'm all of that. But
you're also you.
Yeah, exactly. And you're and I think that's the biggest issue with our community specifically, is that we seek validation from whether it's our mothers, our fathers, our siblings. And they can even say the smallest thing where, like, even if they just say, oh, I'm not sure, that's it.
Yeah.
Like, that can put so much doubt in you. So I think that's a really good point that you made, that not relying on other people's validation for your happiness.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful message.
Yeah, and it's tough because we've not been raised like that. And we've not seen women or people around like that.
Mm.
But I think this generation kind of has enough power to change that narrative, at least for the people going forward, because we're not reliant, you know, thankfully we don't have to rely on our husbands to earn for us. Or, you know, we have enough in our hands to do that. So yeah, hopefully going forward that can at least change. Yeah.
And I just another question popped to my mind, Sonam, is it, do you think tackling depression and mental health issues, do you think a lot of it boils down to the individual being proactive? Because I see a lot of patients coming into the hospital, very young age, and then a part of me says, well, why didn't you ask for help?
Yeah.
You know, it seems so obvious. Obviously, sometimes it can debilitate them so much. So do you feel like we are responsible ourselves for our own mental health as well?
Like, we are.
Yeah.
Like, in essence, we basically are, because it's your own, you know, your mental health is a part of your health.
Mm-hmm.
And just like how you should obviously try to keep yourself healthy and not, you know, drink oil every day or something, you know, it is a part of that.
Mm.
But that's sadly not kind of how we've been taught it. So I don't think you can blame anyone, at least in this, up until, you know, these stages in life. You can't really blame someone for not being able to take their mental health into their own hands.
Mm.
Because if I was a 13-year-old, even if I maybe did know what anxiety was, I don't think I could have spoken up because, you know, I would have felt too self-conscious or I wouldn't have felt like...
It's not only that, it's going back to what we were saying earlier about relying on other people, that we also feel like if we're sad or upset, someone will come and just cheer us up.
Yeah.
Because we live in quite a coddled community where our mothers will be around us, our dads will be around us. So I think one message I want to put out there is, like, just be aware of how you're feeling and be very active in understanding when you're going through difficult times. And I think a lot of it will come through unlearning what we were raised with as young children. And we have to be active in that as well.
Yeah.
In saying, okay, I'm going to start from a completely blank page now so I can actually better my own life and create these improvements.
Well, yeah, it's exactly that. It's like you accept what it was and you can't point fingers
because
the parents were sort of doing the best that they
could
and, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can then change it. And I think that's just basically what all of us have to do and hopefully have the agency to do that. And there's the means to do that.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, if I was still in Bristol, I probably wouldn't have started the group because there wasn't. So London in that way has enabled me to be able to do that. And with whatever resources you have, you can make, you know, you can make a difference.
Mm. So if people want to find you on social media, if people want to join you in London, how can they do that? What's the best way to contact your team?
So yeah, we've got the Insta page at Reroot2018, I think. We're Reroot on Facebook.
Yeah.
I can share my details with you to like put out and stuff. Please do get in.
Are you looking for volunteers as well? Just out of curiosity, in case someone's listening and they want to help out.
Yeah, I mean, the girl that we have, Anjali, who's our star on social media, you know, she just got in contact with us and now she does our Insta and Facebook pages.
So great.
Literally whatever you can bring to the table, we'll take it. But if not, like, even you just sharing our posts on Facebook, like, people can support us in several different ways.
Yeah.
There's no fixed format for that. But yeah, do get it.
Great. Well, thank you for joining me today, Sonam. I really enjoyed this chat.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah,
same
great. And hopefully we can work together on creating more change in not just in London, but maybe in other places as well.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonam, for joining me today, and thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in to Meenal's World as well. If you do live around London or Harrow, you can get in touch with Sonam's team at Reroute 2018. If you are not in London and you're somewhere else around the UK, there's a directory where you can find support groups, and that's www.mind.org.uk. If you're not in the UK and you're somewhere else around the world, I do suggest you try and search online for a support group around you. And if there isn't, you can always speak to your colleagues at work. But I think the main message from today was identify when you are struggling with your mental health and try speak to someone. So until next week, I'm Meenal, and I'll see you in the next episode.